Today on The World, protesters in Hong Kong smash into government headquarters and wave the British colonial flag. Release the righteous, they chant, and hold the police accountable.
Yeah, I was outside the Legislative Council today. It's never right. The protesters was the peaceful one.
I'm Marco Werman. Hong Kong's demands coming up this hour. Plus, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is certain.
There's no doubt there is a connection between the Islamic Republic of Iran and al-Qaeda. Period, full stop.
But U.S. allies are skeptical. They've heard this story before. And a glacier the size of Florida is melting, but how fast?
Is it over a century? Is it over 1,000 years? Or can you do it in a decade?
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Massive protests in Hong Kong today move from the streets through a police line and into the city's Legislative Council building. Protesters broke the glass doors and pried open the gates. The demonstrations coincide with the 22-year anniversary of Hong Kong's handover to China. The protesters' demands are many. They want Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's chief executive, to step down, arrested protesters to be released, and they want a controversial extradition bill permanently removed. The protests have been mostly peaceful, but police use pepper spray and batons in some instances. Tomorrow's legislative meetings and a flag-raising ceremony have been canceled. 26-year-old Louver Tang has been at the protests.
People started smashing into the main entrance of Legislative Council, and they started moving the barricades and trying to smash the glass. And also, there's a metal gate inside the glass, and they broke it.
Did you go inside with other protesters?
No, I didn't enter the building.
Were there any police there, and were they pushing back?
Yeah, there was police. There was, anti-riot police.
For you personally, Louver, what was this day like for you?
It is an achievement for the protesters to force the government to talk to us. So I think, for me, I'm delighted.
Well, one of the demands that the protesters have made is to make sure that what happened in these demonstrations, it's not called a riot, but it's called a democratic movement.
It's never a riot.
For you, what difference does it make what the authorities call what you're doing?
The protesters was the peaceful one. However, it is the police who are using excessive violence. They use tear gas bomb to all the peaceful protesters.
So today, protesters stormed into the Hong Kong legislature, and that's after, several weeks of fairly peaceful protests. Are you worried that the authorities will now look at what you're doing and say, no, it really is a riot?
We can't worry at all, because no matter what, they have different political charges anyway.
Louver, how did you get involved in these protests? Why were you out there demonstrating today?
We just don't want to get too close with China, and we are worrying that people in Hong Kong can be sent to China.
You don't want to get too close to China. You don't want Hong Kong to get too close to China. But isn't that the whole underpinning of the two systems, one nation concept, that you are close?
It's definitely not. If according to the basic law and one country, two systems, only the national security, China government can have rights to in charge.
Well, it seems national security is of huge interest right now for mainland China, especially after protesters went into the Hong Kong legislature today. Your movement is supposedly without a leader. It's leaderless. How are you actually communicating? How were people aware that they needed to storm the legislature today?
Just by the media, by the news, and also by the social media.
Tell me what you heard from people coming out of the legislature. What were they hoping to achieve by spray painting graffiti on the walls and hanging up the colonial era flag of Hong Kong?
Some of the protesters, we are fighting for independence.
We spoke with Joshua Wong last week, who is one of the principal kind of organizers of these demonstrations, certainly something resembling a leader, and he said that he does not want independence.
It is his choice. I don't call him a leader, but he is one of the party's quite active protesters.
Are you worried about where all this could lead? Because there is a base and barracks for the Chinese military in Hong Kong.
I'm expecting for the Chinese army to come out. They would rather use excessive force by asking an army to clear the protesters in the Legislative Council.
You're talking about June 4th, 1989, what happened in Beijing at Tiananmen Square.
Yep.
and you are concerned about that happening again in Hong Kong.
I can't say I was not concerned, but we will be expecting that happening.
Lu Vertang, one of the many protesters in Hong Kong, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Now to Sudan, where pro-democracy protesters also took to the streets of major cities yesterday to demonstrate against the Transitional Military Council. That's the military regime that's been ruling Sudan since April after ousting longtime President Omar al-Bashir. Dalia Abdel-Monem was among the thousands of protesters in Sudan's capital, Khartoum.
We had two clear messages. The people who've lost their lives during the start of this revolution from December until now, they're not forgotten. It wasn't in vain. And the second message was that we demand and we want a civilian government. We refuse to accept anything less than that.
Do you feel that you're any closer to that goal of democracy, though?
Look, it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, we are talking about a regime that's been in power for 30 years. So you're not going to just, you know, remove it overnight and expect democracy to flourish the next day. But we will start inching towards it. I mean, the first step is that the military council released a statement saying, OK, we're willing to go back to negotiations again. So, and that's a big step because they were refusing to acknowledge or even take part in any negotiations.
How are those negotiations going? Are you sitting down or are there representatives of the demonstrators who are sitting down with the military?
The African Union, along with a representative of the Ethiopian government, are acting as mediators. And it's good because you have someone who's not directly involved with what's happening to mediate. It's like a divorce lawyer or a divorce mediation, you know, just trying to get both sides to reach an agreement, to find the middle ground.
Dalia, you spoke about the lives that have been lost in protests since December. The last big protest against military rule was last month, June 3rd, and it ended with a lot of violence. Dozens of people killed, many people injured, and a lot of people said that would slow down your movement. Why did the violence not deter you?
It took us a while to recover from the massacre of June 3rd. I mean, for a whole month, this whole country was just in the doldrums. I wouldn't say we were depressed, but it affected us in every way. But we also used it to galvanize ourselves, to push ourselves forward, and the result was what we saw yesterday.
I mean, it seems the government in Sudan is trying to limit the means that you have at your disposal. For weeks now, for example, the internet has been shut down. How did you manage to find any Wi-Fi to speak with us?
I'm one of the lucky few. My internet provider is actually the same provider for the government and for the banking system and for the foreign embassies in the country. So they can't afford to shut that down. Otherwise, literally, the whole country will be shut down in blackout.
Right.
So I'm just fortunate. It's just a matter of luck, honestly.
What about everybody else? I mean, how are they communicating? How did people manage to organize yesterday's demonstrations, for example?
Mass text messaging, calling, door-to-door canvassing, flyers given out at open markets and at transport stops, you know, and we just managed. We just went back to the old ways. I mean, when we had a revolution in 85, we didn't have internet. When we had a revolution in the 60s, we didn't have internet. So if we were able to overthrow two governments back then, I'm pretty sure we can throw another one today.
Dalia, I've seen on Twitter more than one protester in Khartoum saying they are ready to die for the cause of democracy. How widespread is that sentiment? Are you ready for that?
If we weren't ready, we wouldn't have gone out yesterday. The militia are really armed to the teeth, and they're in your face. Every corner you turn, they are there. And we knew at any second they could just unleash their bullets on us and we could be dead. And so, but we still went out. That tells a lot. That says it, you know, we are willing to die. We're not going to give up so easily and so soon. We've come too far. We've lost too much to give up and say, okay, here you are. Here's the whole country on a silver platter. No, we will fight whatever means that we can peacefully until we attain that goal. And that's our aim. It's always been our aim. And there's no going back. I can't see us going back.
Dalia Abdel-Monem speaking with us from Khartoum. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
They said they would, and now it's happened. Iran has made enough low-enriched uranium to exceed the limit set by the Iran nuclear deal. Until now, Iran had remained in full compliance with the deal despite the U.S. withdrawal last year. Iran's move puts America's European allies now in a difficult spot. They want to save the nuclear deal, but they don't like Iran's actions or Washington's policy of maximum pressure. Jeremy Shapiro is the research director of the European Council on Foreign Relations in London. He's previously worked at the State Department. In Europe, Jeremy, we're talking about France, Germany, and the UK. How have those nations responded so far to this breach?
They're unhappy. They have condemned the breach, and they've asked Iran to come back into compliance. I think at the same time, there's a sort of understanding that the U.S. abandoned the deal first, and they've struggled to try to deliver for the Iranians the promise of the deal, and they're sort of stuck between those two poles.
So the European partners in the deal have declared Iran in breach. Is this move now by Iran, is it enough at a technical level for the Europeans to go to the U.N. and ask for sanctions to be snapped back?
Yeah, it's enough from a technical standpoint, but I think there's some question as to whether the Europeans will do that at this moment. There is also a provision in the deal which says that there can be a degree of noncompliance if other sides are not performing. And the Iranians are making the case that clearly the U.S. is not performing its part of the deal, and even that the Europeans are not performing their part of the deal by failing to give the Iranians the promised economic advantages that were supposed to come from the deal. I think at this moment, the Europeans are probably not in the place where they're going to go to the UN and ask for the sanctions to be put back in place. But the Iranians have also said that in just 10 days, they will start enriching above the 4% threshold. And that creates a much greater proliferation worry. And if that happens, then maybe the Europeans will be forced to essentially give up on the deal and go back to the UN Security Council and ask for the sanctions to be put back in place.
I see Iran looking over at North Korea. North Korea has been rewarded with legitimacy and recognition because it has an effective nuclear deterrent. Is there a risk that Iran could actually just make a dash for the bomb? And how long would that take?
I think that there is a big risk of that. I obviously don't know what's going on within the Iranian system, but I have to say that if I were the national security advisor of Iran, I think it would make sense when you look at what's happened in North Korea versus what's happened in Libya and Iraq, countries that did not have nuclear weapons. If you're worried about war with the United States, that there is a great incentive to acquire a nuclear weapon. The Iranians are under greater scrutiny than the North Koreans were when they acquired nuclear weapons, and they would be taking a great risk to make that dash. The estimates that I've heard are quite various as to how long that would take, somewhere in the area of 12 to 18 months. But I think that the Iranians must be thinking about that when they see the willingness that the U.S. has to threaten them with force and the building ideas that maybe regime change is necessary in Iran.
So, Jeremy, just based on the breach of uranium enrichment in Iran, this news, how much more concerned are you today by the potential of war between the U.S. and Iran?
I don't know that I'm more concerned than I was yesterday, but I think that as we saw just recently, when we came within 10 minutes of a strike against Iran, there is all sorts of possibilities, growing possibilities for provocations. It seems clear that President Trump doesn't really want a war with Iran, but it also seems clear that he's not entirely in control of his apparatus. And that the Iranians feel that it's necessary to show that they are still able to counter coerce the United States. They need to be able to show that they can affect the oil market in the Persian Gulf. And so there's all sorts of possibilities for provocations and counter provocations. And the idea that there could be a repeat of the incident with the drone a few days ago, I think, is a very real one. And it remains so today.
Jeremy Shapiro in London at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. As we just heard, Iran is no longer complying with the nuclear deal as of today. It adds to the tension between Iran and the U.S. President Trump has said he does not want a war, but his advisors have a more hawkish view. In recent weeks, they've been hinting that a law from the 9/11 era could justify an attack on Iran, the AUMF, or Authorization for Use of Military Force. Congress passed that law in September 2001 to give George W. Bush broad authority to go after al-Qaeda And since then, the AUMF has been used by the White House to launch military operations in more than a dozen countries without approval from Congress. Now it seems Iran might be next. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
In the early hours of May 2, 2011, U.S. Special Forces raided a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. They were looking for Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, the man who ordered the 9/11 attacks. Within about 40 minutes, the Navy SEALs had him. One of them shot bin Laden dead, and they were ready to leave.
As we were running out, I look over at my buddy. He's got a bag of stuff in one hand, like, you know, Santa Claus running out of there, but a bag full of goodies.
This is one of the Navy SEALs in an interview with 60 Minutes in 2014. The goodies he's talking about, those are thousands of computer files and documents that they found at the compound. A true gift to researchers like Nelly Lahoud.
This is very high-value information because bin Laden was not addressing you and me. He was addressing his associates in Waziristan. He was writing to members of his family. These were not meant to be for public consumption.
The U.S. government declassified the documents in batches over a period of years. Lahoud pored over them. One question she wanted to answer is, what's the relationship between Sunni extremist Al-Qaeda and Shiite Iran? Close to 6,000 pages later, she has an answer.
It is beyond any doubt that Al-Qaeda viewed Iran in strictly hostile terms. A recurring word in reference to Iran is the Arabic word ghadr, which means betrayal.
Lahoud says after the U.S. toppled the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2001, some Al-Qaeda members taking refuge there fled over the border to Iran. But Iranian authorities eventually arrested some of them and put them in jail. They detained two of Osama bin Laden's sons, one of his wives, and other top Al-Qaeda members. And Lahoud says the documents tell us that the Al-Qaeda members in Iran, they were not exactly welcomed guests.
And in fact, one of the documents states that operatives should read a specific ideological treaties to prepare them to commit suicide if they fear that they're going to be captured by the enemy, with an allusion to Iran.
Now, you might be thinking, why is this important? Who cares how Al-Qaeda viewed Iran?
Iran's connections to Al-Qaeda is very real.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing back in April.
They have hosted Al-Qaeda. They permitted Al-Qaeda to transit their country. There's no doubt there is a connection between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Al-Qaeda. Period, full stop.
In recent months, Pompeo and other administration officials have been trying to convince Congress that Iran does, in fact, have ties with Al-Qaeda.
Secretary Pompeo said it with his own words. He did not.
Pompeo also gave a classified briefing to the House back in May. Michigan Democrat Elisa Slotkin attended. Later, she recounted what Pompeo said.
He referenced a relationship between Iran and Al-Qaeda.
Okay, again, why does it matter that Pompeo is connecting Iran with Al-Qaeda? For that, we have to go back to 2001.
Today we gather to be reassured that God hears the lamenting and bitter weeping of Mother America.
3 days after the 9/11 attacks and after attending the National Prayer Service, members of Congress voted on a bill.
The use of force that we authorize today must be used swiftly and surely.
The bill gave the President of the United States authority to use military force against Al-Qaeda and its associates without going to Congress.
All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The ayes have it.
The authorization for use of military force, or the AUMF, was passed. Since then, presidents from both parties have used that law and similar legislation passed in 2002 to justify military operations all over the world. Drone attacks, airstrikes, detention of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay.
It really runs the gamut depending on what the strategic objective that folks are pursuing there is.
Scott R. Anderson is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
There's ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. You have Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. You have Al-Qaeda and ISIS-associated groups in Libya.
Anderson was a State Department lawyer in the Obama administration. He says to be targeted under the AUMF, Iran would have had to enter the fight against the U.S. right alongside Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
meaning that they are actually attacking the United States and coordinating with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, ideologically, if not actually coordinating. Or at times it's been applied to groups like ISIS that evolved from Al-Qaeda.
But Iran's interactions with Al-Qaeda, he says, don't rise to that level. And so to use the 2001 law to justify going to war with Iran,
it really would be stretching the text of the AOMF and the legal theories that have been developed around it far further than they've been a stretch in the past.
In the build-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, some U.S. officials claimed that Iraq's president, Saddam Hussein, had secret connections with Al-Qaeda. Later on, the government's own assessment determined there were no evidence of any ties.
Thank you for your testimony, Secretary Pompeo.
Today, there is pushback in Congress. In April, Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky asked Pompeo if he thought the Trump administration could use the 2001 law to wage war with Iran.
I'd prefer to just leave that to lawyers, Senator.
Paul pressed Pompeo on this.
If you want to warn Iran, you have to come to us. It's the way the Constitution was written, and it needs to be very clear, and begging off and saying, well, the lawyers, no, this is our history. This is a very important question. It's a very
The AUMF is a very powerful statute.
Scott R. Anderson of the Brookings Institution again.
It gives the president a lot of authority and discretion over how he can deploy U.S. military in a variety of ways that can result in injury and death both to foreign nationals and to Americans.
So he says we should all be paying attention to how it's being used. Lawmakers have tried for years to repeal and replace AUMF. Tess Bridgman of NYU Law School says supporters of the law argue it can't just be repealed.
The United States is still relying on the 2001 AUMF as its domestic legal authority for the conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and other places.
Meanwhile, last month, the House voted in support of repealing the AUMF. But on Friday, the Senate rejected a separate amendment to the defense bill that would have stopped the president from going to war with Iran without approval of Congress. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
When you report on climate change in Antarctica, you come back with some unanswered questions.
This reporting has made me ask, okay, we get this better understanding of what this massive glacier might mean for communities all around the world. What next? What do we do with that information?
Great question. Our story just ahead here on The World.
Hi. I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a production of WGBH, the BBC, PRI, and PRX. 11 feet of sea level rise. This is the scenario that worries scientists if one specific glacier in West Antarctica keeps melting and triggers the collapse of nearby ice. The World's Carolyn Beeler has been reporting on climate change and Thwaites Glacier for several weeks here on The World. Today, she takes on what 11 feet of sea level rise would really look like back home in Boston. We join her as her two-month voyage on an Antarctic research vessel comes to an end.
A couple of days after we sail across the front of the glacier, the winds change. And we started seeing more big icebergs just sort of floating by. And no one really knows why. Until...
That's the image that we got yesterday morning.
Some of the scientists on the ship are sent these satellite images.
Lots of icebergs and brash ice.
Showing that all these icebergs are coming from Thwaites.
So in just a few days, it transformed.
The part of Thwaites Glacier that we had just sailed by basically all broke up. possibly because of that shift in winds. What is the significance of this event in terms of how we understand what's happening at Thwaites?
It's another step in the steady retreat.
This is Rob Larder, the chief scientist on the ship.
One expression of the fact that Thwaites Glacier is losing more and more ice.
And this matters because the ice shelf, which is the portion of Thwaites that extends off of land and floats on the sea, it stabilizes the entire glacier.
This zone here, which is about 40 kilometers wide.
Rob says this big blowout confirms that there's really very little actual ice shelf left at this part of Thwaites Glacier.
You'd expect that this might lead to even further acceleration of flow of the glacier.
So Rob tells me that probably next year, during the next summer thaw, if the line of stability retreats further inland, then we'll know that this maybe was a big deal.
You just have to wait and see.
So if this entire ice shelf crumbles, what's left at the edge of Thwaites is just a giant cliff of ice that's exposed to the warm water that's melting it. And that ice gets thicker and thicker the farther it goes inland into Antarctica, because the seafloor underneath it is kind of like a valley. And if the ice retreats enough to where it reaches a certain thickness, it'll just start collapsing under its own weight. And scientists are afraid there might not be anything to stop it.
You could get a domino effect of icebergs falling off of the edge of an ice sheet.
I talked about this with Ali Graham, who's a marine geophysicist on the ship.
And there's still a debate over what it would look like, and actually we could be observing it right now and not really realize that it's happening, and that's kind of scary.
This idea of how Thwaites might collapse one day, it's not well understood yet, so it's making a lot of people pretty nervous.
How quickly you can feasibly collapse something like Thwaites? Is it over a century? Is it over 1,000 years? Or can you do it in a decade? And I don't think anyone can, hand on heart, say which of those it is yet.
So we start heading home after the sea basically starts freezing up in the area that the scientists want to study. Day 52 of the trip, we reach far enough north that we have some internet again. Morning, Peter.
Good morning.
I notice you are on your phone.
Yes, because we've got internet again. And I'm 27, and this is basically the best thing that's ever happened to me.
And that was kind of a moment when it felt like the spell of the ship was broken. So we weren't just our own floating universe off in the middle of nowhere. So
it's like one extra step on the way home. It's like graduating to home slowly, and this is like another tick.
Peter Sheehan, one of the oceanographers, was like, his feet were up on a table in the lab, and he was reading his phone, cackling, catching up on his favorite newspaper columnist.
Actually, this column is a little too vulgar to talk about on the BBC World Service, which is why I'm cackling in the corner.
You know, we've been on the ship for, you know, a month and a half, almost 2 months at that point. So the farther north we get, the antsier everyone gets, you know, to be back home and to get off the ship. We finally start to see Punta Arenas, the little town in southern Chile where we had gotten on the ship and where we would get off. And all of us gathered up on the bridge to see this little city approach.
Almost feel it. It's like right there. The land.
It's so close.
It's so close.
Like land was right there and we were about to get off the ship.
Wi-Fi network on my phone. What's happening? I don't know what to do.
So we walk up the pier and we go to an ATM, which is, in all places, a casino. It was this total, like, sensory overload.
So where is it? One up?
One. He said this way.
And then we look around to find a bar because we all wanted a beer or something after 2 months on this ship.
Why don't we go to Shackleton?
We end up at the Shackleton bar.
Yeah, there are many of us.
And we all bring a bunch of leather chairs together and sit down and toast each other with our first drink.
eye contact.
There's a final group dinner the next night, and then everyone gets on flights and scatters. Then I'm flying back toward Boston. As the airplane lowers down over the airport, I'm really struck by the fact that it's completely surrounded by water. And it made me think about, you know, what will this look like if all that ice I saw in Antarctica really does melt? So if you look at the major climate reports, there's a huge amount of uncertainty about how much sea level rise we should expect by the end of the century. The big gold standard UN report, it projects up to 3 feet of sea level rise by 2100, and it only includes a little bit of melting from Antarctica. But its numbers have this big asterisk that's basically like, if Antarctica starts to collapse, these numbers could be really wrong. So I wanted to understand how a city plans for that uncertainty, and I thought there's no better place to do that than Boston. So my first stop is Boston City Hall, where I talked to one of the city's climate change officials.
My name is Alicia Pagan. I work with the City of Boston for the Environment Department.
Who tells me how much sea level rise Boston is planning for.
So we predict that there will be around 9 inches of sea level rise by 2030, around 3 feet or 40 inches by 2070, and then somewhere between either 2 feet or 7 feet by 2100.
So these numbers actually do take melting in West Antarctica into account, which surprises me because a lot of national and city figures don't. But even here in Boston, when we incorporate those numbers, it still doesn't mean you can plan that far out because the uncertainty is just so huge.
I think we'd like to plan for 2100s. It's just the science right now is so uncertain that it's planning for a variance of 4 feet. So when we have better data, then we can make more informed decisions.
And I ask her,
the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is where I was this winter reporting.
You know, if we see the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet and there are 11 feet of sea level rise, is that something Boston can handle?
I don't have an answer for that.
And she basically said, we don't know yet. I don't know.
There's a lot of people interested in making sure that we can do this.
But you don't know yet if...
I can't say for sure right now. Yeah.
And that was really powerful to me.
Test 1, 2.
I wanted to get a sense of what 2 feet of sea level rise from Thwaites and 11 feet from the West Antarctic ice sheet would actually look like in Boston. So I walked actually across the street to Faneuil Hall.
This is one of the hearts of historic Boston. So it is actually the country's first mall was Faneuil Hall.
That's now a huge tourist destination in Boston. So there are a bunch of street performers and buskers out. And I meet up with Julie Wormser, who's from the Mystic River Watershed Association and is an expert in what sea level rise is going to look like in Boston.
With 2 feet of sea level rise in Boston, a storm that we would expect to have maybe once in a century before sea level rise, starts to become once a year or once every 10 years.
And while that may not sound like a lot, how hard is it going to be to continue renting this vital retail space if it floods that frequently?
So there's so much commerce right here, right at risk of flooding.
Okay, so that's 2 feet. That's something that the city is planning for. But what does Boston look like if the whole West Antarctic ice sheet collapses someday and pushes up sea levels by something like 11 feet? And she points out on the ground in the cement, there's this sort of squiggly line that shows the historic coastline of Boston.
That was the original shoreline of Boston.
Right in front of Faneuil Hall.
So on this side is water. So we're walking through water right now.
We are miraculously walking on water right now, for sure.
We're in an area that the settlers in Boston filled in and used to be the ocean.
They filled in a lot of the harbor with horses and shovels.
They filled in about a third of Boston.
So now about a third of the city of Boston is at risk of coastal flooding when sea level rises between 2 and 8 feet higher than it is today.
And if we see 11 feet of sea level rise, everything that was filled in Boston is going to be underwater again. And that's not just Boston. Bangladesh, much of the Netherlands, cities up and down the East Coast, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, they've all filled in marshes and ocean to build land. And all those places want to return to the sea. One estimate puts the cost of protecting just the U.S. from sea level rise for just the next 20 years at close to $500 billion. So the hard question going forward is going to be, who and what are we going to protect and how we're going to pay for it?
I got it.
So I wanted to talk to one more person whose neighborhood would be impacted by this massive sea level rise that would come from the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
All right, Carolyn, what do you want me to show you?
Marco Werman lives several blocks from the river in Cambridge.
Show me a couple of your
favorite spots. I have him give me a bit of a tour of his favorite spots of his neighborhood.
Maybe my most important landmark in Central Square, which is John's Barbershop.
Where he's been getting his haircut forever.
Gave me my first haircut and gave me my most recent haircut in Boston. That started in 1995.
Wow.
So, yeah.
We walk down the street and go to his favorite used bookstore.
I love the smell. I love the vibe. And on a rainy day, I can just spend like hours in this.
He likes to go in and he says, smell the old books.
So you can see Aleppo Palace from here. That little white building. What does
that
look like?
We go by his favorite falafel shop. And we stop just outside of his house, Victorian, I guess, where he lives on the top floor.
So you're about to see how I get greeted every day when I come home. Because the second he hears me, he's going to start barking.
And I pull out this map that's basically an elevation map of his neighborhood that shows, you know, with no protections, which there will be, you know, what will be underwater.
Yeah. So, right, yeah. So this is
Marco's house would be underwater.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm flooded.
The barber shop would be underwater.
Aleppo Palace could be okay.
The bookstore looks safe.
Yeah, they could move all the books on a high shelf. Yeah, I am in the risk zone.
And to me, this is why this matters. Because it's not acreage and square footage of land that will eventually be inundated. It's communities and stories and histories. It's sometimes hard to wrap our heads around why we should care about what happens to a giant chunk of ice thousands of miles away. But it really is all connected. And this piece of ice is going to have an impact on farms and global financial centers and historic places and communities just like this one, bookstores and barbershops all around the world. And this reporting has made me ask, okay, we get this data, what next? We get this better understanding of what this massive glacier might mean for communities all around the world. What next? What do we do with that information?
The World's Carolyn Beeler produced that story with Ian Koss. The collapse of a glacier the size of Florida is hard to imagine, but we've got graphics. Go to theworld.org/Antarctica. Only four teams remain in the pinnacle of soccer competition, the Women's World Cup. Tomorrow's semifinal lines up Team USA against Team England. Meanwhile, men's national teams from across Africa are competing in the Africa Cup of Nations. Big celebrations in the host country, Egypt, when the home team advanced to the next round. But some Egyptians, especially Coptic Christians, are feeling left out because there are no Christians on the national team's 23-player roster. The BBC's Shaima Khalil, an Egyptian and a soccer fan, has more.
There are around 100 million people in Egypt, and around 10% of them are Copts. There have been just a handful of successful Coptic footballers in the Egyptian Premier League and national team. In fact, the 23-man squad currently playing in the Africa Cup of Nations has no Coptic players. Mina Benderi is a Coptic Christian. He's in his early 20s. He tells me about his football-mad childhood.
I used to play in church teams and church championships, nothing more, and my family weren't enthusiastic. They kept telling me, "You are not going to go far playing football. You are a Christian, remember?" As I got a little older, my football improved, and my Muslim friends took me to play with them. And when I did, they used to change my name for me. I became Ahmed. And when I did, most of the managers said I was a good player and didn't know I was a Christian. And I knew that I wasn't going to make it because of my religion and who I was. The reality is that if I am a Christian, then I have to choose between my religion and football.
There seems to be this almost unanimous notion that Christian children just don't have the skills for football. Could that be it, rather than their religion? I asked Ishaq Ibrahim, a Coptic activist for religious rights.
We don't have accurate statistics, but we have indicators. First question, are Coptic children built differently than Muslim children? Of course not. Do Coptic children go to schools and live in areas different from Muslim children? No, they don't. So, if these children live and exist in the same environment as the Muslim children, with no obvious physical distinction, then this indicates that there is discrimination against Christian children.
My full name is Magdi Abdel Ghani Sayed Ahmed. I am a president of a professional footballer association.
You say that you haven't found skilled enough players in the Coptic players that you've seen, but we have millions of Christians in Egypt. You're trying to tell me that none of them are good enough to play for big clubs or
they
play for
continue.
The national team.
Maybe he's good, but he preferred to not be a professional player. This is nothing with religion. This is because there is not player good enough to prove themselves.
But then what do you say to the Christian players who say they don't choose us because of our religion? What do you say?
I say to him or I tell him, you are not good enough. You must work on yourself. You must prove yourself. You didn't play football easily.
So you think that they shouldn't give up, that they should keep trying?
Yeah. They should keep trying.
Are you convinced then that the national team, it represents all Egyptians?
Yeah. Present all of the Egyptian and all the most of them. The fans are going to be Christian and Muslim. You don't know who's Christian and who's Muslim. Most of the Christian, they like to watch game.
The Africa Cup of Nations is happening, and I'm wondering how you feel about it. Are you excited about the national team playing, about Egypt organizing it?
No, I won't be supporting Egypt, and I know you are a bit surprised. How can I support a team that discriminates against me and other players? Why would we support a team that won't support us?
Coptic Christian soccer player Mina Bandari, ending that story from the BBC, Shaima Khalil in Alexandria, Egypt. Guadalajara, Mexico is still digging out from an incredible storm. That's not just rain, it's hail, a lot of hail. Up to 5 feet of it fell in some parts of Guadalajara. We've seen photos of people making snow angels and bulldozers pushing hail out of the streets. But how unusual is this, right, as summer is getting going? That's what I asked Claudia Martinez. She's a hydrometeorologist at the University of Guadalajara.
It's unusual, the spatial distribution of the hail, but hailstorms here in the rainy season are quite usual. The topography here in the city is a little bit complex. Some places are higher than others, and every time we have rainfall, the water currents go to the lower places. The same water currents also carry the hail to lower places and get bigger accumulations.
So in the lower kind of elevations of Guadalajara,
yes.
That's where you found the big accumulations of hail?
Yes.
I mean, the photos are pretty astounding. Were the streets still icy today when you came into work?
Yeah. I saw the pics and even walk aside the accumulations because I live in one of the affected areas.
What did you think when you woke up on Sunday and you saw exactly what had happened?
I woke up because of the sound of the hail hitting my window. And I had an idea what was going to happen next, because a few blocks from where I live, it's a little bit lower area. I thought there's going to be a little bit of flooding and we're going to have ice in the morning.
Mm. And the hailstones themselves, were they large or were they small?
They were small, like the size of a bean or a rice.
The quote from the governor of Jalisco State seemed a little dramatic, but maybe you can tell us what you think. He said, hail accumulation more than a meter high, and then we wonder if climate change exists. So, Claudia, what has the conversation been like since Saturday about what this strange precipitation means?
Well, I don't want to mess with the governor's opinion because it's his own opinion. But as a hydrometeorologist, I have my own opinion. And I've been talking with the senior meteorologist. And, well, we've reached the conclusion that this is not directly related to climate change. This is only a very casual situation that happened because of the topography itself.
Well, it's not snow, but did you see any kids playing in the accumulations of hail?
Yes, including myself.
Still a child at heart, are you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Claudia Martinez, a hydrometeorologist at the University of Guadalajara. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for this Monday. You might have noticed we have brand new theme music today, composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.